Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The book is Reagan, His Life and Legend. Max Booth, the author. We continue the story with Ronald Reagan running for the presidency in 1976. Gerald Ford is in the White House, having ascended to the presidency at the resignation of Richard Nixon. And the challenge to Gerald Ford is in the primaries. Max tells the story extremely dramatically. The question is, at this point, Reagan was fine with the conservatives and looking to the center of the party. He came very close, Max. What was the opinion of the Reagan supporters at the time? Why he didn't overwhelm Gerald Ford? Was there a moment where he could have won it and didn't?
I mean, I think there were some moments when he could have won it and just, you know, fell short. And I think the key one was early on in the New Hampshire primary, where he came very close to winning, but lost by something like 1,000 votes. But it was, you know, it's always very hard to unseat a president of your own party in the primaries, right? It's never happened during the open primary period of the post-World War II era. And Reagan came, in fact, closer than anybody else to pulling off that feat, where even after the primaries were over by the beginning of the summer of 1976, it still wasn't clear who had won. And both the Ford and Reagan campaigns were politicking right up until the convention to secure the delegates. And Ford did manage to secure the delegates. But then Reagan won the heart of the convention of the Republican Party with this very graceful and moving speech he gave in defeat at the convention. And a lot of people left that convention thinking that they had nominated the wrong man.
In the years between 76, Gerald Ford loses the presidency to Governor Carter of Georgia. The years between, Ronald Reagan goes back to his first love. He's on the radio. Was he doing the Saturday morning, or was he doing daily at that time, 76 to 80?
I think it was a couple of days a week that he was doing, but it's interesting because he was offered a chance to be on TV, I think even on 60 Minutes, top-rated show, but he instead chose to sign a radio contract because he feared that if he was on TV, he would be overexposed, whereas, you know, he was somebody who believed in the power of radio, and so he did these short radio commentaries while Carter was in office.
And the Reagan decision in 1980 to run for the presidency. Again, I check in on Nancy Reagan because she's such a powerful figure and he trusts her so completely, his one good friend. Did she want to run for the White House?
Again, I think she would have been perfectly happy not to run. I think Reagan himself was the architect of his own presidential ambition. And, you know, he was certainly bucking the trend because, you know, a lot of people expected that after the 1976 primary loss, and he was, you know, 65 years old, people expected he would retire. But no, he came back at the ripe old age of 69 to seek the presidency.
We must mention the ranches. There have been a series of ranches. I don't have California in my head, so I don't know how far afield he's going. But you make the point, which makes me, again, hesitate about how complicated he is. He loved to get his hands dirty at the ranch. I remember lots of scenes of him cutting brush. I guess that's what he did for weekends. Is that where they would leave L.A. and go to brush cutting?
Yes. I mean, during his presidency, whenever he had, I mean, during weekends, they would normally go to Camp David. But when they had a slightly longer period of a week or so, he loved nothing better to go to his ranch outside of Santa Barbara. And it was fascinating because, you know, Reagan was a guy who had basically no friends. And I found the person who was probably his closest friend as president, and somebody that nobody has ever heard of, a fellow named Dennis LeBlanc, who was a former California state policeman who protected Reagan when Reagan was governor. And then after Reagan left the governorship, Dennis LeBlanc and another former cop named Barney Barnett went to work with Reagan as basically his ranch hands at this ranch. And Reagan loved nothing better than to spend time with Dennis and Barney clearing brush, painting fences, doing ranch chores. Those were actually the people that he most loved to associate with in the entire world. It wasn't all these Alfred Bloomingdales and Walter Annenbergs and all these other magnates that he was often photographed with. It was these kind of down-to-earth blue-collar guys who had been California cops.
And was he cutting brush between 76 and 80 before the White House? Was he doing it at that
point? Oh, yes. No, absolutely. He was not only that, he was actually reconstructing his farmhouse. And it was a very primitive affair, and it still remained pretty rustic. But he did a lot of the reconstruction and expansion work himself.
The run for the presidency, John Sears and Bill Casey. Who are they, Max? What do we need to know about them?
Well, John Sears was Reagan's campaign manager in 1976 and then in the first part of the 1980 campaign. And he was kind of a political genius, but one who eventually grated on the Reagans, because in part because of his demands for total control. And so he started purging a lot of the Californians from the campaign, people like Mike Deaver and Ed Meese, who were very close to Reagan personally. And that really grated on Ronald and Nancy Reagan. And Reagan did not establish a close rapport with John Sears. And so on the day of the New Hampshire primary in 1980, which Reagan won, Reagan did something that he almost never did. He fired John Sears, and generally he hated to fire anybody, still traumatized by his father's unemployment in the 1930s. But he was fed up enough with John Sears to fire him, and to run or to be campaign manager, campaign chairman. Nancy brought in Bill Casey, who was a guy who had very little experience in politics. He had been an OSS spy during World War II and then had been a pretty successful lawyer on Wall Street and Republican fundraiser. And she brought him in to oversee the campaign after the firing of John Sears.
And Bill Casey, he is the alleged October surprise. It's Casey. Is that it?
Yes. I mean, the October surprise was the name for this theory that the Reagan campaign reached out to Iran before the 1980 election to basically signal to the Iranians that they should not release the American hostages prior to the election, which would have boosted Jimmy Carter and might have won the presidency for him. And I found it's not ironclad evidence, but I found pretty strong evidence that this probably happened. And it wasn't anything that Ronald Reagan himself was aware of. The culprit was Bill Casey. He was this former OSS spy who had great devotion to various plots and conspiracies, and he was the one who was meeting with Iranian emissaries.
The campaign is very close that summer. The polls show no gap at all until we come to the September, October. The economy is in very sad shape. At the same time, there's a debate very late in October, I believe. Is there a moment where the gap opened up between them, or was that a surprise on Election Day, Max?
No, I think the gap opened up weeks before the election. I think the debate was certainly a turning point because, Reagan was such a polished television performer. He really wiped the floor with Jimmy Carter, and he had that one famous line in the debate, "There you go again," which was really a knockout blow, even though what people forget is that Carter was right and Reagan was wrong, because the prelude to that remark was Carter accusing Reagan of having opposed Medicare, which was true. Reagan had opposed Medicare in the early 1960s. He had warned it was socialized medicine would lead to the end of freedom in America. But Reagan said, "There you go again," and claimed he hadn't really opposed Medicare, that he'd backed another bill that was just as good, even though it wasn't. The other bill would have only covered about 1% of seniors as opposed to all of them. And so on the facts, Carter was right, Reagan was wrong, but it didn't matter because it was such an effective rhetorical blow. And, he won the debate and won the election.
Max Boot, the author of Reagan, His Life and Legend, March 30th, 1981, when we come back. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Max Boot, the author of the new Reagan biography, His Life and Legend. It is a cloudy day, is my memory, in early spring 1981. Ronald Reagan makes a speech in Washington. He's leaving the building. Shots are fired, and Reagan is hit. A number of other members of his staff are hit. And this becomes a crisis that Max presents very dramatically. This is 69 days into the administration, and Reagan conducts himself heroically with humor and attempting to ease the tension all around him, especially his wife, who is, as Nancy rushes to the hospital to be with him. He is very close to death often, several times. Max's presentation is extremely moving. At the same time, Max, I'm interested in what happens afterwards. He recovers amazingly. And that leads to success in Washington. What is it that allows him to then move on his domestic ambitions so quickly?
Well, I call the chapter on his shooting finest hour, and it really was Reagan's finest hour. Remember, this was Reagan had never been in combat. He'd spent all of World War II on a soundstage. But here he was acting very heroically after being shot and joking with the doctors, saying, "I hope you're all Republicans," telling Nancy, "Honey, I forgot to duck." And of course, people were horrified by the shooting, and he came very close to death, much closer than his aides had let on at the time. But then when people heard about how he had behaved after being shot, and he'd really behaved, you know, kind of like a wisecracking Warner Brothers hero of the 1930s, except this was not a soundstage. This was not scripted. This was real life. Being shot hurt a lot. He was close to death, but he kept his good humor. He kept his head about him. And I think that gave him a huge popularity boost and really cemented this bond between Ronald Reagan and the American people that really lasted throughout his presidency. And the most immediate political benefit was a boost in his popularity rating and also a huge boost in the chances of passage for his first budget, which cut spending and cut taxes. And the prospects for Reaganomics when Reagan was shot were still very much uncertain. But after, you know, he came back to the White House, he spoke to a joint session of Congress where people gave him rapturous applause. And by that point, it was kind of a foregone conclusion that his program was going to sail through Congress.
Yes, again and again, Max, you are very detailed in what the facts are in the economy and what the Laffer curve does and what Reaganomics does. But I'm reminded again and again about the Hollywood line. I believe William Goldman wrote it for The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. "When the facts replace the legend, print the legend." That's Ronald Reagan speechifying. He speaks legend, not facts.
Yes, absolutely. And Reagan's superpower was kind of the ability to see the world as he wanted it to be, not necessarily as it was, but also to convince other people that to see the world the way he saw it. And one example of that, if you cite Reaganomics, is that his program was to cut taxes dramatically and raise defense spending dramatically. But while doing that, he also expected that he would eliminate the budget deficit. And no serious economist thought this you could possibly do that. But Reagan convinced himself that cutting taxes would actually stimulate so much economic activity that the government would actually get more money than it had at a higher tax rate. And that, of course, turned out to not to be true. And so when he left the presidency, the one regret that he expressed was he said he was very sorry that the budget deficit had gone up because he had promised to balance the budget by 1983. Never happened. Instead, budget deficit is larger than ever. But it's kind of amazing that he ever imagined that a program of tax cuts and spending increases could possibly result in a balanced budget. But yet he did. And this was something he became very convinced of.
The Troika, we need to name them because they were so powerful in the first term. All the work in the first term pays off, but it's their agenda, and we're talking about the domestic agenda. We'll come to the foreign policy in a moment. James Baker, Ed Meese, and Mike Deaver are responsible for the success of the first term. Is it because they cut down or they eliminated people getting access to the president? Is that the secret? Because there have been presidencies since where they're back and forth about access to the president. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Well, I think the big picture, I would say Ronald Reagan was a great leader, but he was a poor manager. He was not somebody who was deep into the weeds of government policy, and he really needed people who could manage for him. And he found that with, I think it was really Jim Baker, who was by far the most important of the Troika. And the appointment of Jim Baker, I think, was actually in many ways the most important decision that Reagan made as president. Very unexpected, because normally, presidents appoint some crony as their White House chief of staff. But Baker had, in fact, worked against Reagan, had worked for Ford in 76, had worked for Bush in 1980, and yet Reagan still appointed him. And then, of course, Reagan still wanted a place for his old California aides, Ed Meese and Mike Deaver, and so thereby he created the Troika. And many people initially expected that Ed Meese, who was seen as being more conservative and more doctrinaire than Jim Baker, many people expected that Ed Meese would emerge as the most powerful member of the Troika because he had been Reagan's chief of staff in Sacramento. But in fact, that turned out not to be the case at all, because Ed Meese was very disorganized, not very clued into the ways of Washington, whereas Jim Baker, nicknamed the Velvet Hammer, became one of the shrewdest operators Washington had ever seen. And Mike Deaver, who was an old advertising man and really Reagan's image meister, he threw his influence behind Baker. And so, the talk of the Troika was really misleading, because it wasn't three equal power centers. It was really Baker accumulating more and more power as the presidency went on, and Meese being more and more sidelined.
The other significant achievement in the first 2 years, it is August of 1981, and Ronald Reagan made a remark during the campaign about a woman on the Supreme Court, and he does it, Sandra Day O'Connor. And that was seen as a great success at the time. Is that accurate, Max? We have about a minute.
Yes, absolutely. He had agreed to appoint a woman because he, like many other Republicans, he faced a gender gap, and he appointed Sandra Day O'Connor, even though many right-wingers were fearful that she would vote to uphold Roe v. Wade, which ultimately she did. But Reagan was not an absolutist at all and didn't really care that much about abortion. His primary concern was about not setting criminals free, and he bonded with O'Connor over her background growing up on a ranch, and so he was delighted to appoint her.
I smiled when you reported the Senate vote 99-0.
Hard to imagine today, right?
It's impossible, Max. 99-0. I also like the fact that Senator Day O'Connor's name emerged because she was, as you describe her, an old flame of what becomes Chief Justice Rehnquist. Was he on the court at the time? He was, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, yeah.
So Sandra Day O'Connor joins, and the domestic achievement of the taxes and the deregulation, and Ronald Reagan telling a story that the American people wanted to hear. We're going to turn to the Cold War. This is Reagan, His Life and Legend. Max Boot is the author. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I'm spending time talking about a new biography I highly recommend, Ronald Reagan, His Life and Legend by Max Boot. All these years later, it's good to review what we lived through, we boomers. And you Gen Xers, you were children, and you Gen Zers, you weren't here yet. But this is the man that everybody rolls their eyes and goes, Ronald Reagan, the great communicator. Well, he was. He knew how to tell stories. But when you meet foreign policy, the stories only go as far as what happens later. It's surprising to me, Max, how many of these challenges in the two terms of Ronald Reagan are still with us. Iran, still with us. Afghanistan, still with us. The troubles in the Caribbean, Havana, Nicaragua. El Salvador seems to be solved, but Central America is not. Still with us. It's only 40 years. Poland is somewhat solved. That was a major challenge because it was under the Soviet boot. Let's talk about the Soviets. Ronald Reagan had no patience whatsoever with communism. And yet, he became a person who wanted, it's not détente, it's not Richard Nixon's détente. It goes back and forth between being confrontational and looking to do business about treaties. How should we think about him in the Soviet Union?
Well, I would say that in his first term, he had a somewhat muddled and unsuccessful policy towards the Soviet Union. The most high-profile elements were his confrontational tactics and rhetoric. He boosted U.S. defense spending massively. He called the Soviet Union an evil empire. But he was also at the same time behind the scenes trying to reach out to the Soviets and trying to establish channels of communication, because he was very worried about the danger of nuclear Armageddon. That was something that, in fact, was an obsession with him. But as he later complained, you know, I wanted to meet with the Soviet leader, but they kept dying on me. And during his first term, he dealt with these, decrepit geriatric leaders like Brezhnev and then Andropov and Chernenko. And things only really began to turn around with this policy towards the Soviet Union in 1985, when the younger and more dynamic Mikhail Gorbachev came to office. And Gorbachev was really a black swan, somebody who wanted to reform this dictatorial system even as he rose to the top of it. And as I argue in the book, I don't think that Gorbachev's desires to reform were driven by Ronald Reagan. Gorbachev was not trying to keep up with the U.S. defense buildup. He, in fact, wanted to end the arms race and to spend money on social concerns. But I think Reagan's achievement was not in bringing Gorbachev to power or forcing the Soviet Union to reform. His achievement was in recognizing that Gorbachev was a different kind of communist leader, somebody he could do business with, as Margaret Thatcher told him. And they established a rapport at their first summit in Geneva in 1985 that I think changed history. And that allowed Reagan and Gorbachev to work together to reduce nuclear armaments and to peacefully end the Cold War. And I think that's, in many ways, the ultimate tribute to Reagan's pragmatism, because few would have expected that this hardline anti-communist who had been warning about the dangers of the Soviet Union since the 1940s, that he would be establishing a friendship with the world's number one communist and working so constructively with him. But that is, in fact, what Reagan did.
You mentioned Margaret Thatcher. They were great, great, great friends. And Brian Mulroney, those were the two leaders you identify as Reagan getting on famously with. I love the scene of Mulroney and Reagan singing "When Irish Eyes Are Shining Together."
Right.
Is there a video of that, Max?
Probably. I'm not sure, but probably, yeah.
It'd be charming to listen to all these years later. Now, about the Soviet Union, there were two documents, National Security Document 32 and 75. That's his staff. That's not Reagan, because those are confrontational documents.
Yeah, those were produced by Bill Clark, his national security advisor for part of his first term, and they were confrontational. They called for a policy of confronting and bringing down the Soviet Union, but the actual implementation was much more varied. I mean, for example, one of the very first things Reagan did in 1981 was to lift the grain embargo that Jimmy Carter had imposed on the Soviets after the invasion of Afghanistan. So, you know, these national security documents are often cited as kind of a blueprint for bringing down the Soviet Union. And because the Soviet Union eventually fell a few years later, a lot of people try to draw a causal connection. But in fact, I think it's much more complicated than that. In fact, you know, I asked George Shultz, who was Reagan's Secretary of State, I said, Mr. Shultz, did the Reagan administration have a plan to bring down the Soviet Union? And he said, no, I wish we did, but we didn't.
Change in personnel is significant to flag here. The Chief of Staff, James Baker, for the second term goes to Treasury. And Don Regan, who is a Wall Street magnate, joins as Chief of Staff. And you make it very clear that this, he might not be the worst Chief of Staff ever, but he's in competition. What didn't work?
Well, as Jim Baker said to me, Don Regan, who had been a former CEO of Merrill Lynch, Don Regan liked the chief part of the title, but he didn't understand that he was staff. And he really thought that he was the decision maker and not the president. And maybe that would have been okay if Regan had tremendous political instincts, but in fact, he had horrible political instincts. And, you know, as I mentioned, in many ways, the best decision of Reagan's presidency was making Jim Baker the White House chief of staff. In many ways, the worst decision was casually allowing Jim Baker and Don Regan to swap jobs at the beginning of the second term. That made no sense, because Don Regan turned out to be this awful chief of staff who presided over one problem after another, ultimately culminating in the Iran-Contra scandal.
There are a number of problems that result from Don Regan's management. There are successes, too, and Max covers all this in great detail. I regret leaving out things, but I wanted to make sure that we mention Hezbollah. It's born at the Marine Barracks. Well, it's born at the U.S. Embassy bombing in 83 and then the Marine Barracks bombing in 83. That leads to dealing with Iran in an unusual fashion. Is there any way to characterize how Ronald Reagan thought of Iran? Did he think he could bring it in from the cold?
Well, unfortunately, the Reagan administration's dealings with Iran were a fiasco, not very unusual, because that's true of many, many presidents since 1980. But yes, I mean, you know, he sent in the peacekeepers who were blown up at the barracks in Beirut in 1983, then pulled them out. But then what happened was Hezbollah, as the organization became known, began seizing American hostages. And Reagan was very exercised about the fate of the hostages. He wanted to get them out. And his then national security advisor, Bud McFarlane, suggested that there were these supposed moderates in Iran that we could deal with. We could ship them weapons. In return, they would release the hostages and Iran itself would take a more moderate pro-American direction. And of course, this blew up in their face because the Iranians took the weapons. They released a few hostages, but then they seized more hostages. And then this moved from the realm of an unsuccessful policy to a great scandal. When John Poindexter, who succeeded Bud McFarlane as national security advisor, and his aide, Oliver North, decided to take the profits from the sale of weapons to Iran and to funnel the profits to the Contras in Nicaragua, these anti-communist rebels, even though Congress had passed the Bolin Amendment forbidding aid to the Contras. And so this was a scandal that blew up in Reagan's face in 1986. He could have actually been impeached because of it. But ultimately, his salvation was the fact that he was so hands-off. I mean, because he was so hands-off, he got into the scandal, but he also got out of it because his defense was, I did not know about the diversion of money to the Contras. Now, if Richard Nixon had said that, nobody would have believed him because everybody knew that Nixon knew everything that was going on. But with Reagan saying, I didn't know what was going on, it's very believable because everybody knew what a disengaged, hands-off manager he was. But this was kind of a near-death experience for the Reagan administration from which the president just barely emerged.
Philippines, Haiti, and South Africa all illustrate different parts of Reagan, especially about South Africa. He never spoke for the victims, or he did not speak for the victims of apartheid. Clearly. Is that correct, Max?
Yeah, I think that's basically true. And as one of his own appointees pointed out to me, he had kind of a double standard because he spoke very eloquently about human rights violations by the Soviet Union and behind the Iron Curtain. But he was not so exercised about the human rights violations of apartheid and, in fact, vetoed a very tough sanctions bill passed by Congress. And Congress wound up overriding his veto. So that was not a proud moment for the Reagan administration.
And I mentioned Manila because Paul Axelt was a determinative. The Marcos dictatorship, all these decades later, Marcos is back in, but this time it's a descendant who's a strong relationship with the United States. Haiti, 40 years later, it's worse than ever, Max. Did they have a chance after Duvalier left to solve that, or was it always going to be the anarchy we saw today?
Oh, gosh, it was probably always going to be a mess. But, you know, the fall of Marcos was interesting because, you know, Marcos tried to steal an election. There was a massive people power uprising. And initially, Reagan was very friendly to Marcos. He had known him since his time as governor of California. But he was then convinced by Paul Axelt and George Shultz and others that Marcos could not stay in power. And this became part of a trend of Reagan promoting democracy and even willing to see the overthrow of right-wing dictatorships instead of simply highlighting the excesses of left-wing dictatorships. This was kind of the beginnings of a more pro-democracy agenda in the Reagan administration and the Republican Party.
The book is Reagan, His Life and Legend. Max Buda is the author. When we come back, farewell. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm visiting with Max Booth, the author of a new biography of Ronald Reagan, His Life and Legend. The late Reagan administration is troubled in all directions for foreign policy. Domestic policy seems to be on overdrive. We have Max mentions a number of books that were popular in the 1980s. I'd forgotten about them. Lesson Zero, I'd forgotten that was the 1980s. And I mention all of that because we come to the departure of Ronald Reagan from the White House. I can remember seeing a video of the helicopter flying away. So I wanted to review some of his most famous statements and where they came from. "Honey, I forgot to duck." Where did he get that, Max? Did he make it up at the spot?
I think it was an old Hollywood movie line that he quoted at the exact right moment.
To Nancy Reagan. And the one about...
Oh, actually, it wasn't a movie line. I think it was a boxing line. It was Jack Dempsey, I think, or some other boxer in the 1920s who said that after losing a fight.
And Ash Heap of History, was that Reagan original?
Yeah, that was from the 1983 Westminster Address. I think that was Reagan repurposing communist rhetoric against the Soviet Union.
Yes, it magnified the expectations. And there you go again. Is that Reagan original at the one and only debate with Mr. Carter?
That was a Reagan original, yes.
And of course, I love the remark he makes about Alzheimer's as the diagnosis has been made clear to him. He cared a great deal about what happens to Nancy. Post-presidency, he moved into an office where he remained as pleasant as ever, always looking on the bright side of things. And he had chance to reflect. I think you make a distinction, Max, between the book that Nancy Reagan wrote and the book that Ronald Reagan wrote. And I get the impression, having never read either of them, that Nancy Reagan's book can be helpful, but Ronald Reagan's is not to a biographer such as yourself. Is that correct? There were no details in there worth repeating.
Well, no, I think you're referring to their diaries. Nancy Reagan's diary, she used it to write her memoir and then destroyed it. So nobody has read it. The Reagan diary, Ronald Reagan's diary, was published, and it was useful. I mean, no question about it, because it was a day-by-day recounting of his presidency, but it was not very deep or reflective. It was really basically him taking his daily schedule and offering a few thoughts on, but everything was great and grand and good, and he was just such a relentlessly upbeat person that there was not much psychological insight to be found from it, or very limited psychological insight to be found from his diary, I guess I would say.
That makes you into a detective, Max. That's how I thought of you in reading the book. You had a case, you knew where it was going, but you had to walk the cat backwards to the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, Reagan was somebody where even Nancy Reagan said that part of him was walled off even from her, and his closest aides said that he was very hard to know. So it's definitely a major challenge for any biographer.
Genial and aloof, and that was a term that everybody understood about Ronald Reagan. But no one complained, genial and aloof. And I puzzle now that you can reflect on this enormous amount of work you've done. Was that from the childhood? Was that because he'd learned to, as an actor, to turn his emotions on and off depending on the part? Where did he first understand that that was a defensive mechanism that would always serve him?
Well, I trace it back to his childhood, where, again, he didn't really get close to the other kids because they were moving all the time because his father kept losing one job after another. He didn't want people to know about his dad's drinking. And so he was kind of aloof from everybody, kind of erected this mental wall around himself. And what I figured out is that, he certainly came across as genial, but his anecdotes and stories, his jokes and quips, they were actually a way to keep people at a safe remove. He kept conversations at a very superficial level and never delved deep with anybody, didn't even know what was going on with his kids' lives, for example, or his aides. But, everybody was happy to spend time with him.
His own memory, I think I have this right, Max. His own memory of what he achieved was the economic recovery of the first term and the morale of the United States. Let's deal with the economic recovery. I don't have the statistics in front of me. They're in Max's book. But the recovery is largely salesmanship. I mean, it was okay coming out of a recession, but it wasn't what we remember today through the fog of history, which is the spectacular growth of the 1980s. I believe you make the case that it's happened before.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at economic growth rates during the Reagan presidency, they're actually pretty similar to the Nixon administration, not only a tiny bit higher than Carter and below that of the Bill Clinton administration. But he got his political timing was exquisite because there was a severe recession from 1981 to 1983. But by the time Reagan was running for re-election in 1984, growth shot up to 7% that year, and then it fell back down to earth. But it was that towering economic performance in 1984 that allowed him to win 49 states.
Luck, you mentioned luck. He was a very lucky politician. Or did he take advantage of where he had luck and walked away from where he didn't? How do you see it, Max?
I think he was a very lucky politician, but he also made his own luck and figured out how to take advantage of it. And you know, the fact that, you know, the economic recovery, I think a lot of it was due to Paul Volcker, and the chairman of the Fed, who raised interest rates to take the inflation out of the economy. But Reagan supported Volcker, which was not easy to do. And there was a lot of political blowback, and his popularity plunged in 1982. Democrats won the midterm elections, but he stayed the course and, you know, received the political rewards in 1984.
I tell a story that Max tells about one of the early weeks in the White House when he went into the Oval Office, the first day or second day. The Resolute desk that the president sit behind, it was made out of timbers from a famous ship. But Ronald Reagan had a chair, I believe from California.
Right. In,
and when he sat in his chair, because he's a tall man, he couldn't get his knees under the desk. He didn't complain. He sat sideways. It wasn't for some days or weeks, I can't remember which, Max, until somebody recognized that they could lift the desk up and make it 2 inches higher. Did he ever comment on that, Max, that the desk now fit him as it hadn't before? Who did this?
Maybe he did. I'm not aware of it, but that's really an example. That was one of the secrets of his success. He was so modest, so unassuming, so undemanding. He was, you know, a hard guy to hate, basically. And even people who disagreed with his policies had to grudgingly say that they liked Reagan personally because he had such a winning personality. And, you know, despite all of his success, he always remained very down to earth.
And the great communicator, was he comfortable with that as a way of remembering him?
I think he was, although it sometimes had a sliding inference to suggest that he was just a guy who read a script, which wasn't the case at all. He often wrote his own scripts. And, you know, one of his great lines was he was asked, you know, he said, you know, some people say they can't understand how an actor can be president. I don't understand how anybody but an actor could be president. And he certainly understood how to use the bully pulpit better than just about anybody who has ever occupied the office.
The book is Reagan, His Life and Legend. Max Boot is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.